Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Listener, Obscura is supported by listeners like you. If you'd like to support us, head to patreon.com/obscuracrimepodcast and get access to episodes like Black Label or Fireside Chat if you'd like to get to know me more. That's patreon.com/obscuracrimepodcast. And hey, at the end of the month, on Halloween, we're going to be putting out a pretty heavy Black Label episode. So, it's a great time to join. Listener, what do you refer to the night of October 30th in your neck of the woods? If you live near the Cincinnati, Ohio area, you may know this date as Cabbage Night. The night is celebrated based on Scottish traditions. Unwed women and girls would often pull cabbages to examine the stalks in an attempt to determine their future husband's weight. After using the cabbage as a means of fortune-telling, the young women would then take the cabbages and throw them at the homes of their neighbors. Rotting cabbages are also traditionally used as a means to light roaring neighborhood bonfires. In New Hampshire, and some parts of Canada, you may have heard of this night being referred to as Gate Night. On Gate Night, teenagers and young adults would often unlatch the gates to livestock pens, allowing the farmers' animals to roam free. People in Detroit, Michigan, know the night as Devil's Night.
Detroit firefighters are bracing for Devil's Night. That's the annual pre-Halloween arson spree. Last year, 281 blazes were reported. City officials are taking steps to try and stop the fires. Youths under the age of 18 will be under a dusk-to-dawn curfew tonight, and more than 35,000 volunteers will watch vacant buildings and patrol neighborhoods with fire extinguishers.
And the holiday would be taking an increasingly destructive turn. In the 1990s, as mischief escalated, from the standard trees festooned with toilet paper and dog feces on porches, to acts of arson, by 1994, there was a citywide campaign to restrict the holiday by enforcing early curfews, establishing neighborhood watch programs, and even an attempt to rebrand it as Angel's Night. That obviously didn't work.
Because of the destruction caused by a few on Devil's Night, the rhythm and heartbeat of a great city gets slowed down.
You have to have a place to live. It's pitiful. We gotta start doing something about it now.
On October 30th, get mad. Help us stop Devil's Night arson. For one day, Wednesday, October 30th, for 6 hours, you can help stop Devil's Night fires in your neighborhood. To volunteer, call 224-3450. Get mad. Get involved. Stop Devil's Night arson.
And so the arsons remained so widespread that they were forever immortalized in movies like The Crow. Great movie, by the way. In Martha Moxley's Greenwich, Connecticut neighborhood, they called the night before Halloween Mischief Night. It would be that night, in 1975, that 15-year-old Martha Moxley would take her final breath.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat, next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
The community of Belhaven is a picturesque neighborhood of sprawling mansions, professionally manicured lawns, and residents who meet to play tennis on Sundays. To say Belhaven is a luxurious neighborhood would be an understatement. Belhaven isn't only an exclusive community in the state of Connecticut. It's one of the most exclusive neighborhoods within the United States, attracting old New England money and some of the country's most powerful people. In 1974, the Moxleys would decide to join the ranks of these elites by moving into the ritzy neighborhood, and later learn firsthand what money, power, and influence could buy. Like many other teens, on Halloween Eve, Martha had gone out with friends to party and partake in some acts of minor vandalism. The group Martha was with spent the evening hopping from house to house, party to party, throwing around a few rolls of toilet paper along the way, before finding themselves at the home of the Skako boys. As previously mentioned, the community of Belhaven is home to some of the wealthiest families in the United States. However, even among the winner circle, the Skakels were by and far the most wealthy and influential family in the area. This was due in part to their relation to the Kennedys, whom they were related to through Ethel Kennedy, widow of Senator Robert F. Kennedy. Being related to a Kennedy came with many perks, but it also came with its shared tragedy, the Kennedy Curse. And, as it's often called, the Kennedy Curse has been cited as the cause behind a seemingly endless line of tragedies that hovered over the family like a dark cloud. The Skakels were bitten by the curse when their mother Anne passed away due to cancer, leaving their father Rushton alone to raise their seven children. Rushton buried himself in his work, while the children were often left in the care of the revolving door of nannies and private tutors. This was very much the case when Martha and her friends stopped by the Skakel home to spend time with 17-year-old Tommy Skakel and his younger brother, Michael. Rushton had been away on business, and the children were all left in the care of a live-in tutor who had been watching the French Connection while the teens partied. Both Tommy and Michael had developed a bit of a crush on Martha, and that night, the boys invited Martha and another girl Martha was with to sit in Tommy's car and listen to music while the rest of the teens in Martha's group made mischief around the neighborhood. Michael began flirting with Martha, but Martha wasn't interested. According to Martha's friend, who had been with her that night, Martha had her heart set on Michael's older brother, Tommy. As the teens were still sitting in the car, another one of the older Skakel brothers approached the vehicle and told the teens that he was going to take his cousin home. Michael decided to leave with them, and Martha was last seen leaving the party with Tommy that night. Other witnesses reported last seeing Martha and Tommy roughhousing and kissing. She never made it back home. At approximately 10:30 p.m., Dorothy had been painting when she heard what sounded like commotion outside. It was not distinct, but she recalled hearing dogs in the neighborhood barking as if they were trying to alert to something. Dorothy packed away her painting supplies and fell asleep on a couch in the library. Her husband had been away on business. At 2:30 a.m., Dorothy was woken up by her son, who had also gone out that night. That's when they realized Martha had never came home. After calling all of Martha's friends and other neighbors in hopes someone had seen her daughter, Dorothy and John set out to find her. By the following morning, residents from the block would also join the search effort. It would be just after 12:30 on the afternoon of October 31st that one of Martha's classmates would find her. Martha was found tucked underneath a pine tree on her family's property, covered in blood. She had been bludgeoned with a golf club. It was a Tony Penna No. 6 iron golf club that was found broken into pieces and covered with blood. The blows were so hard that the teen's assailant broke the 6 iron into 4 pieces, only 3 of which were ever recovered. One of these pieces would be used to stab Martha in the neck. Her pants and panties were found around her ankles. However, there was no evidence to conclude that a sexual assault had occurred. A neighborhood that existed inside of a bubble of wealth and privilege, where crime was practically unheard of, now had a murder on their hands.
But on October 30th, 1975, a beautiful 15-year-old girl was bludgeoned to death. Former Greenwich Police Detective Stephen Carroll got the call.
We knew it was a girl because her jeans and her panties had been pulled down below her knees. And the head, her hair, was just red with blood, soaked with blood.
Martha Moxley had been brutally beaten with a golf club, then stabbed through the neck with a broken club shaft. Her lifeless body lay next to a tree, not far from where her mother, Dorothy, had been anxiously waiting for her daughter to come home.
The chief medical examiner for the state of Connecticut performed an autopsy of Martha's body and reported that she suffered multiple lacerations of the scalp, with fractures of the skull and contusions and lacerations of the brain, causing her death. The medical examiner also revealed that the weapon used to inflict injuries and cause the death of Martha Moxley was the Tony Pennant No. 6 Iron Golf Club. The medical examiner classified the death as homicide. Whispers around town suggested a vagrant had somehow infiltrated the quiet upper crust community. However, police had their own theories, and within days of the murder, police began to focus the investigation on Tommy Skakel, who at the time was the last person known to have seen Martha alive.
In the days after the murder, the investigation focused on 17-year-old Tommy Skakel. Tommy was the son of Rushton Skakel, who is Ethel Kennedy's brother. And Tommy had been with Martha the night of the murder, along with a group of friends that included his younger brother, Michael Skakel.
It was fairly obvious to us that this was a jealous attack. Definitely had sexual connotations. And it was probably Tommy.
Rushton would allow police to search the Skakel mansion. There, a golf club set, similar to the set found at the scene, was found. On May 17, 1976, James E. McDonald, a firearms and tool mark examiner and head of the New Haven, Connecticut Police Crime Laboratory, microscopically compared the number 4 and 6 irons. In doing so, he detected matching green pigmented acrylic residue within the grooves and lettering of both golf clubs from the club found at the scene and the number 4 found in the home. He also noted identical marks caused by the same tool on the groove face of each club. On that basis, McDonald rendered the opinion that the two clubs were of the same set. After the pieces of the golf club found at the crime scene were matched, Tommy admitted to police that he had been with Martha that evening, but he said he went home early that night because he had a book report due on Abraham Lincoln the following day. Police questioned Tommy's teachers, who told them there was no such assignment due, and Tommy would later change his story.
Tommy says that yes, he did go in the house at 9:30, but he returned outside for this 20-minute, prearranged 20-minute sexual interlude with Martha at the edge of the property. Michael said that yes, he did take Jim Terrien home with his brothers, but came back at about 11:15. And he went over to Martha's house, climbed a tree near the house, and was throwing pebbles at the window trying to get her attention while he's masturbating in the tree.
After Tommy passed a lie detector test, the Skakels would stop cooperating with police. For the time being, the investigation would come to a grinding halt. Listener, an important aspect of this case to understand is that when you're a family as powerful as the Skakels, especially for the time, evading justice isn't as difficult as one might think. Detectives working the case were well aware of the family's Kennedy's connections and feared that the slightest step over the line could not only compromise the investigation, but can cost investigators their jobs and possibly their own freedom. When you're a Kennedy, even only by marriage, you can get away with murder. At least, that's what Michael Skakel believed when he allegedly told to a fellow resident at a substance abuse treatment center in the late 1970s. You see, Michael had allegedly made a full confession to murdering Martha Moxley the night she went missing. This information would not be made public for nearly 25 years, with the newspapers also reluctant to take a closer look at the suspects in the case. For fear of legal retribution, Martha's story would fade out of the spotlight. It wouldn't be until the early 1990s that her case would gain a renewed interest. In 1991, another Kennedy cousin, William Kennedy Smith, would stand trial for rape in Palm Beach, Florida. Smith's charges would eventually be dropped. However, after his acquittal, a bizarre rumor began to surface. There were some claiming that William Kennedy Smith had been at the Skakels' home in Greenwich when Martha Moxley had been bludgeoned to death. While the rumor didn't hold much water, it would be the push needed to reinvigorate the case that, according to the Moxleys, had been left untouched in at least a decade. Author Dominic Dunn had been following the William Kennedy Smith case when he decided to investigate the possible connection to Martha Moxley himself. His investigation led him to look closely at Michael Skakel, Dunn's fictional account of the murder in his book, A Season in Purgatory, would nudge investigators to reopen the case. With advancements in DNA, investigators believe that there was a chance Martha's clothes she had been wearing on the night of her murder may have contained trace amounts of saliva or other bodily fluids, and took swabs for testing. These results were never conclusive. However, some media outlets began reporting that the DNA was a match to Skakel's. Later, in 2014, Skakel sued the polarizing former HLN host, Nancy Grace, for making this claim. The case would be settled out of court. Hoping to put the story to bed for good, Rushton Skakel hired a private investigator to conduct his own investigation into the case. The report, compiled by a private firm known as the Sutton Report, would leak into the media. This report would conclude that not only had Tommy's story changed since he first spoke with detectives in 1975, but that Michael's recollection of events that night had also changed several times. In the story given to investigators hired by the Skakel family, Michael placed himself at the scene of the crime on the night of Martha's murder. This would make Michael, not Tommy, the last person to have seen Martha Moxley alive. Even with this new information available, placing Michael at the scene near the time it was believed Martha was attacked, it was a shaky ground for prosecutors to build a case. A 1998 book written by former Los Angeles police detective Mark Furman, Murder in Greenwich, would further cast blame on Michael Skakel. The evidence Furman presented was too great, even for a Kennedy to dodge. By August of the same year, the state of Connecticut would assign a single investigator to act as the grand jury in the case. Kenneth Littleton, who had been the Skakels' tutor at the time and had been watching the Skakel children on the night Martha was murdered, was also at one time considered a suspect. Littleton was granted immunity in exchange for his testimony during these grand jury hearings. Evidence was also re-examined. In January of 2000, what was discovered during these hearings was determined to be sufficient to charge Michael Skakel in the 1975 murder of Martha Moxley. Since the crime occurred when Skakel was 15 years old. You know, listener, finances is a subject that I know some people like to avoid, but coming off of a large move myself, in which I spent in the neighborhood of $7,000 to $10,000 to move cross state, finances have been on my mind ever since. My wife and I, we've hit a point where we've realized it's time to make some serious money moves, to take control of my finances by using a Chime checking account with features like no maintenance fees, fee-free overdraft up to $200, or getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. And hey, let me tell you, we've all experienced overdraft before. Chime has overdraft protection, with Chime allowing you to overdraft up to $200 with no fees. Get spotted on debit card purchases and cash withdrawals. No money fees or maintenance fees. Over 50,000 fee-free ATMs. To date, Chime has spotted members over $30 billion. Make your fall finances a little greener by working towards your financial goals with Chime. Open your account in 2 minutes at chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. Chime feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank, N.A. or Stride Bank, N.A. Members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Boosts are available to eligible Chime members enrolled in SpotMe and are subject to monthly limits. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The 39-year-old was originally charged as a minor. After the first court date, Skakel would approach Martha's mother, Dorothy, for the first time since 1975. Skakel looked Dorothy in the eye and told her, "I feel your pain, but you got the wrong guy." In 2001, Skakel's case would be passed from Connecticut Juvenile Division to the Supreme Court for review. There was no direct evidence tying Skakel to the murder. The evidence presented to the jury was comprised of damning statements and focused on Skakel's bizarre and erratic behavior throughout the years following Martha's murder. The following year, after just 4 days of deliberation, Skakel was found guilty. Dorothy and Martha's brother John hugged one another, both of them choking back tears as the verdict was read. It was a case the Moxleys had been waiting to seek closure to for 27 years. Michael Skakel would be sentenced to 20 years to life, and the Moxleys' nightmare seemed to have come to an end. In an impact statement written by Dorothy Moxley on August 28, 2002, she wrote, "Writing this impact statement has been very difficult. I had to bring up all the thoughts I had worked so hard to repress for 27 years, and so I became very emotional. For me, it all came out in tears. There were tears of joy when I remembered when Martha was born. Our first child was a boy, and so I really wanted a girl. Martha was born on August 16th, 1960. She was sweet and cuddly, and a joy in every way. I would hold her and look at her and daydream about the life she would have. We had so much to give her that I knew she had a chance for a very full and happy life. Although she was only 15 when she was killed, I find some comfort knowing she had always been a happy child, had many friends, and was fun to be with. She showed great promise for the future." Tears of sadness flowed freely when I thought of all the beautiful and wonderful life experiences I hoped she would enjoy and what she could have been and done. Martha was smart and curious, so she probably could have gone to college, earned a degree, and a career, maybe even traveled the world. She had a sunny, warm personality and liked people. I don't doubt for a minute she would have married and had children. I think she would have been a wonderful wife and mother, for she was an exceptional daughter. She was liked and admired by almost everyone she met. I was very proud of my very attractive and popular daughter. The tears that filled my eyes when I thought of Martha's death were the worst. It is so hard for me to think of that way. Martha died, and how frightened she could have been. For years, I prayed that she did not see the first blow from the golf club, and that she died immediately after the first blow. I couldn't stand the thought of her suffering. I know now that isn't the way that it happened. I know now that she must have been very frightened and suffered a great deal. The tears from anger came very easily. I now know who killed Martha, and I think I know why. What makes me so angry is that none of this had to happen. This tragedy was compounded and made even worse because, for almost 27 years, the investigation was hampered and stalled by lies and clever legal maneuvers. Michael Skakel's lawyer complained that it took 27 years to solve the case. Does he expect the prosecutor to reward the Skakel family for making the investigation almost impossible by not cooperating and not for telling the truth? Do they not understand the meaning of truth and justice? I also shed tears when I feel a great sense of pride. I cried when my son married Kara Navin. I cried when my two grandchildren were born. I cried when I heard the jury foreman announce the verdict, guilty. I cried when my husband David died. He was only 57. His early death may have been hastened by the stress caused by not being able to find justice for Martha. I have spent almost 27 years of hell and anguish trying to live what some would think of as a normal life, but stressed to the limit, trying to find truth and justice. I was blessed by the devotion and diligence of the lead investigator and other members of the state's attorney office in Bridgeport, and by the love and cooperation of my son and his wife, and other family members and dear friends. With all this help, it still was not easy. I am a victim. My son John is also a victim. Michael Skakel sentenced us to a life without Martha. I think he should be responsible for his actions, so it is only fair he serve a similar sentence. I think he should spend the rest of his life in jail. I think he should be sentenced to life. Listener, this was a relief that would be short-lived. Skakel would spend 10 years behind bars, but on October of 2013, a judge would grant Skakel a retrial. Serious questions were raised about Skakel's defense, and whether or not prosecutors may have swayed the jury's opinion by referring to Skakel as a, quote, spoiled brat. During his original trial, Skakel's bail was set as $1.2 million.
Relatives and supporters applauded when the judge approved bail. Michael Skakel did not speak to reporters, but his lawyer, Hubert Santos, did.
There were two tragedies that occurred in Greenwich, Connecticut in 1975. The first was, of course, the murder of Martha Moxley. The second great tragedy occurred in a courthouse in Norwalk, Connecticut in 2002, when Michael was convicted of the murder of Martha Moxley, a murder he did not commit.
Skakel was serving 20 years for bludgeoning Martha Moxley with a golf club. A Connecticut judge set aside the conviction last month after Skakel argued his trial attorney, Mickey Sherman, failed to properly defend him. Moxley's mother, Dorothy, and her brother John.
Yeah, we stand behind the state. We know the state will appeal, and we're confident that Judge Bishop's decision will be overturned.
In July of 2016, Skakel's cousin, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., wrote his own book, presenting his own theories on what happened the night Martha Moxley was murdered. He claimed Skakel was framed and that the real killers were out walking free. According to Kennedy, the real murderers were two Bronx teens who had been in the neighborhood that same night. While the book provided no new evidence, it came as a slap to the face to the Moxley family, who had reason to believe that the right man was serving his sentence for Martha's heinous murder. Kennedy's book did little to help Michael Skakel's case, and in 2016, Skakel's sentence was reinstated.
We're hearing from family members of Martha Moxley, the Greenwich teenager who was killed back in 1975. All this as the murder conviction of Kennedy cousin Michael Skakel has been reinstated. Moxley's brother telling ABC News, "We're happy with the decision and appreciative, as always, with the effort of the state of Connecticut that they put into this." Skakel convicted of that murder back in 2002, but then in 2013, a judge threw that conviction out, ruling Skakel's original defense attorney, Mickey Sherman, botched the defense. But on Friday, the state Supreme Court ruled to actually reinstate Skakel's murder conviction. Sherman, happy with that decision.
Of course, I felt vindicated. I always knew that I did a decent job.
Skakel, now 56 years old, working with his current attorney to decide whether or not they will appeal again.
2 years later, in May 2018, Skakel would again be released after careful review of his case by a Supreme Court panel of judges. Only one judge of the four on the panel voted not to have the case overturned.
We have some breaking news tonight in an infamous murder case that has haunted Connecticut for generations now. The state Supreme Court has reversed itself and overturned the conviction of Kennedy cousin Michael Skakel in the murder of his neighbor Martha Moxley a half century ago in Greenwich. The high court ruling in a 4-3 decision that Skakel's trial lawyer was so ineffective, his right to a fair trial was compromised. A year and a half ago, the court came up with the exact opposite decision. Skakel was found guilty in the murder 15 years ago. He's been out of prison since 2013 while the court considered his latest appeal. At this point, tonight, it is unlikely Skakel will face a retrial. Some of the witnesses in the case are dead. Skakel's attorney released a statement tonight saying, "This has been a long road for Michael, and we are grateful to the court for its ruling today."
On October 30th, 2020, the 45th anniversary of Moxley's murder, the state of Connecticut announced it would not retry Skakel for Moxley's murder. In September of 2018, a new suspect was introduced in the case, Gaetano Tony Bryant, cousin of basketball player Kobe Bryant. claim that he knows who killed Martha Moxley.
Can you please state your full name and spell it, please, your last name?
Okay. Hitano Pierre Bryant. Last name is B-R-Y-A-N-T. First name, G-I-T-A-N-O.
Okay, and what was the middle name again?
Pierre.
And that is...
P-I-E-R-R-E.
Okay, basically, now you're aware that this is being videotaped,
yes,
right?
Yes, I am.
Okay. You're here today because you have information in regards to the Martha Moxley murder case that goes back to the 1970s. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Because we had smoked some marijuana and we had also drank, probably at that point in time, probably about 3 6-packs. Adolf always had a thing. He had met Martha previously, and he had a thing for her. He really liked her.
Okay. How did he meet her? Just from Belhaven?
Just from Belhaven, and also at some mixer we went to. We went to, like, I wish I remember the name of the church. We went to a couple of mixers, and the first time he met her was when they have a street fair in Greenwich at the end of, around the middle or the end of September.
Okay.
And they close off the main street, and they sort of have a street fair.
Okay. So are you saying, when would he get brave about Martha to talk about her? After he had some drinks in him? Or?
Of course.
Yeah?
Everybody gets brave then.
Okay. What would he
say? And there's also some eggnog because, you know, people would laugh and say, I know what you're trying to do, blah, blah, blah. She's not interested. Oh, yeah, she is. She likes me. She likes me. No, she doesn't. Wanted to fuck the shit out of her, and he wanted to go caveman on her.
Okay, now what does that mean? Well, how would you do...
Just take her, grab her, and have her the way he wanted her.
Okay, he would say this?
Yes.
Did he seem like he really wanted this girl badly?
No doubt in my mind.
Okay.
No doubt in my mind.
How often would he talk about this?
It was kind of an ongoing thing, but it was kind of weird because it would... During the week, if we weren't going to Greenwich, he would sort of mention it... You know, a couple times, yeah, I really liked her. She's pretty, blah, blah,
right.
blah.
Okay.
But if we were going to Greenwich, it would just really get exacerbated. I mean, just really hyped up.
Okay. More than any other girl, he would talk about her.
I don't remember him talking about any other girl.
Okay. Any other things you remember him saying about her?
Loved her beautiful blonde hair. I mean, he was completely intrigued with this woman. With this girl.
Intrigued or obsessed?
I'd say obsessed.
Obsessed with her?
Yes. You need to think about something else. You need to think about somebody else that's more, you know, obtainable because it's not going to happen.
Okay.
She's not even interested in you.
Would you guys really kid him a lot?
A lot. We would bug him about it.
He'd say, someday I'm going to have her at all? Or
all the time.
He would?
All the time. That's what I said. He said he was going to have her. It wasn't, I'm going to. It's going to happen.
Okay. He never said that about any of the other girls from Belhaven or Greenwich or anything?
No. That's what's so crazy about it, because he met a lot of other girls too.
Okay.
But he talked about her, and that was his main focus.
Okay.
And I know that, I mean, that's all he wanted to do and he got jealous of other guys coming up to her and talking to her.
He did.
He would just get upset and say, you know, I don't understand why she's spending her time with those guys when... She can be with me. I'll take care of her, blah, blah, blah.
Okay. A lot of this was about a month before she got killed?
It was...
Around that time frame?
From the time he met her, which, as I said, like, beginning of September, mid-September, until the murder, that's what he would talk about. And we probably had been in Greenwich 4 or 5 times between that period.
And this has got, this proceeded to get worse with him?
It built up with him. It built up tremendous.
Okay. So you mentioned before something about getting her from behind and dragging her?
Yes.
Are you saying dragging her by her hair or what?
Definitely by her hair. That's what the whole concept of
He would say this stuff.
Okay, yeah, but
okay.
Going caveman meant, you know,
right.
Grabbing and pulling off and
okay.
Not just picking up, it's pulling off. Okay. Anything you put him up to.
You said anything that you dared him to do, he would
anything
do.
Anything you dared him to do, he would do.
You dared him to take a girl caveman style? Would he possibly do that?
There's no doubt in my mind.
Okay. There was something wrong with him. All you had to do was look at him to know it.
Oh, you could tell.
What kind of demeanor did he have?
You could say, a lot of kids were afraid of him.
Okay.
because he was big. He was explosive.
He was strong.
Very much so.
Again, he was how tall about?
I'd say 6'2", 6'3".
And about how much did he weigh?
Oh, easy 200.
As a 15-year-old?
Easy.
But very strong.
Very strong. And they had made some statements also that, you know, we just got to get into something. I'm not going out of here unsatisfied.
Who said that?
Burr and Adolf.
What did that mean, unsatisfied?
Well, we had been talking about, this night we've been talking about the caveman.
Okay.
And so.
This is the night that Martha died.
This is the Martha, she died that night. And okay. This is the kind of conversation that had been going on since we got on the train. So okay. It's been going on for 3 or 4 hours already.
Both when you were sober and now?
And it got a little bit more exacerbated.
Okay.
So I had X amount of time to get to the train station. I already had my ticket. Mm-hmm. And I asked them, you know, hey, I'm leaving. You guys want to go with me? No, we're going to stay tonight. We're not going any place.
I think you mentioned in one of these reports something about the golf club.
Everybody touched that club. I should say those clubs. Everybody in Bellhaven touched those clubs. We used to hit balls behind the house.
Okay.
And we used to also hit balls at cars.
Whose clubs were these?
Were Skankle's clubs.
Skankle's clubs, okay. Where would you get them from?
Just pick them off the back porch.
Okay. Anytime, were they ever on their yard at all? Or?
Yeah, I mean, the back porch to me is this extension of their yard.
Okay.
So they're just laying around. You can walk and trip over one.
Okay. That night that Martha died, did anybody walk around with a golf club in their hand?
Had a couple people with clubs there that night.
Like who?
I had a club. I picked one up and swung it. Everybody, I'm telling you, those clubs went through tons of people's hands.
Now, swinging it at a golf ball or just holding it and walking with it?
There were some kids that had picked them up and would start walking with them. I know that, and I'm not going to sit here and fabricate or anything. Mm-hmm. But I picked up one.
Right.
Bird picked up one. Adolf picked up one. Jeff Burns picked up one. And we were, like, goofing around. I just remember hearing those words and saying, you know what? I've had enough.
Okay. So them saying the words while holding a golf club.
Yes.
Going to get me a girl.
Yeah, but it's, you know, I got my caveman club.
Right.
And I'm going to go grab somebody and pull them by hair and do what cavemen do.
Okay. Okay, so you said goodbye to them that night, right?
I just said, I'll see you later.
You're saying out of control. How bad do you think these guys were by the time you left them? Capable of what?
Anything.
Okay.
Anything.
Because of what? Their demeanor? Because of the drugs? Because of the alcohol? What?
A combination. Of everything, plus the whole dare factor. There was always a dare between those two. I mean, they were always trying to outdo each other. And they would just push each other. Burr would push Adolf. Okay. Because Adolf, for some reason, had a chip on his shoulder, or he felt that, you know, that he just wasn't up to snuff or whatever.
Okay. Well, one of them would dare the other one. That person wind up doing the dare?
Oh, no doubt.
Really?
No doubt. There's countless episodes in the city and that I could, you know, spend an hour explaining to
right.
you, you know, grabbing women in the city, asking, you know, people crazy directions and
yep.
snatching their bags and all kinds of stuff.
Okay. Okay. So you just said, I'm out of here, and you left.
I left.
Okay. When was the next time you saw them?
I saw them that Monday. The following Monday.
Okay.
And it was not a pleasant experience because there was overtures made about, well, I got mine. And
Who said that?
Adolf said it to me that day, and then Burr in a roundabout way says, yeah, we did what we had to do, and blah, blah, blah.
You got to expound on that a little bit for me.
It's tough.
I mean, whatever
we did it. We achieved the caveman.
Both of them?
In different situations, yes.
Did you say to them who, what, where?
No.
Okay.
Because I knew who they were implying. It was so obvious because, I mean, the next day, it was all over. I mean, it was everywhere.
Right. So they said to you, we've achieved one of our, according to some of the things that you had said, we've achieved one of our fantasies.
Yes. Yes.
We got her caveman style.
Exactly. And I didn't even, at that point, I didn't want to ask any questions because I was afraid for myself, and I already knew.
You knew who they were talking about.
I knew exactly who they were talking about.
Who were they talking about?
They were talking about Martha Moxley.
Okay.
It was always, they would take me to the limit and never mention the name. But, I mean, come on.
Okay, what did they say? What other things did they say? I mean, as far as doing what to this woman?
We grabbed her. We got her. You have to understand, for so long I tried to just, as a teenager, I wanted to run away from this. Mm-hmm. And as an adult, I tried to block it out. Okay. Because I felt that it wasn't my place.
Through all those early years, why didn't you come forward to anybody?
For one thing, I was afraid of being automatically pinned in as a suspect. My family didn't have money to defend me from a lawsuit that, you know, it'd be easy. If they could convict Michael Skagel on circumstantial evidence, I think I would be an easier conviction than Michael.
Why?
I didn't have the resources to defend myself.
Okay.
And Michael's family has much more resources than mine.
So they admitted to taking a girl caveman style, and the definition that they always gave you and that you understood it to be was with a club,
by force, dragging off,
and dragging the girl off by her hair.
That's correct.
Okay. And you do realize that's how Martha was killed.
If I told you that, I've never, ever, I never wanted to know.
Okay.
And that's how panicked I was. I didn't want to know.
Okay.
I've never, to this day, I've never looked at any autopsy reports. I've never read any books, any magazine articles. I don't want to know.
Okay.
And I just, they made a joke out of it. I didn't think it was funny. And so I stopped hanging out with them slowly but surely. And as things sort of dissipated, I just dropped off.
Okay. Even though they never mentioned Martha's name to you.
I knew who it was.
You knew who it was. Do you believe in all your heart that they killed her that night?
I think that they were there.
Okay.
I think that...
Well, we know they were there.
Oh, no. There's no... No, they were there when the murder took place.
Okay, now what does that mean, though? You have to explain that to me.
See, there's another party that we really don't talk about, and he had fear in his heart. And that was Jack Burns.
Right, definitely.
He had made mention to me several occasions that, you know, something bad happened. These were bad guys. And was, you know, he was sort of reaching out to me to help him. And I said, Jeff, I can't do anything to help you. What am I going to do?
Right.
What am I going to do? What do you know that I don't know?
Right.
And I tried to bait him. And
was this after the murder?
It was after the murder. He's like, just Tony, you got to stay clear. They're bad guys.
Okay.
They're going to get you.
Meaning Offenburg.
Yes.
Okay, and what did he say about that? They're going to what?
They're going to get you in trouble, and they're already in trouble. You just need to keep your distance.
Did Adolph and Burr stay in Belhaven that night?
Yes, they did. They stayed with the Burns.
They did?
Yes.
Do you know that for a fact?
I know that for a fact. You could stay at their house, and they would never know, though.
Okay.
The parents would never know.
Okay.
It was a huge
house.
They
told you they stayed there?
Yes.
They did.
And Jeff told me that they had also spent the night that night.
Okay, so Jeff told you that they stayed there, and Adolph and Burr told you they stayed in Belhaven at the Burns' house.
That's correct.
Okay, I'm just trying
before to... Before I left, they were like, I said, what are you guys going to do? Well, we're going to stay at the Burns'. Okay, I'm out. Bye. See you.
Okay. So do you believe that they killed her? Either the two of them or possibly...
I think they were definitely involved.
Okay, Adolph and Burr.
Yes, there's no doubt in my mind that they were involved.
Do you think anybody else would have been involved with them at all?
I think there could have been other witnesses, but I'm not really sure.
Okay.
They're unpredictable. I mean, I could tell you all kinds of stories about being in the subway and all the crazy stuff that used to take place, and it's just, it was too much.
You've never had any other contact with them throughout the years?
None whatsoever.
And none of them have reached out to you?
No.
At all. And you had no reason to want to...
None at all.
They were obsessed with Martha Moxley.
Adolph was.
Adolph was.
But starting, Bert put him up, he would fuel fire.
Okay.
I mean, because anybody else, if I would have, if it would just have been Adolph and I was like, you know what, you're wasting your time.
Okay.
Forget about her. Forget about her. There's other girls here.
Forget but Bert would.
Bert, no, you can do it.
Okay.
You can get her.
Okay. So the talk before the murder, and like you said, it really built to a crescendo. Okay, of we're going to get a girl caveman style.
That's correct.
Okay.
Bryant claimed back in 2003, his two friends had been responsible for the murder that night. While these two friends have not been publicly identified, reporters say the men suspected by Bryant of killing the teen have denied the allegations. This information was never allowed to be presented at Skakel's original trials.
I think there was a, at that time, there was a press pack mentality, a press scrum that was led by Dominic Dunn and by Mark Furman, which said that, which had this narrative that said, okay, here's a cat, there was a Kennedy that got away with murder. And the problem with the story was that neither Tommy Skakel nor Michael Skakel, and they kept going back and forth between them, neither of them are Kennedys. Second of all, neither of them committed murder. Nobody knows who murdered Martha Moxley.
Cabbage Night, Mischief Night, Devil's Night. The night of October 30 is known as many things. For the Moxley family, they know it as the night their whole world came crashing down in 1975. Do you believe Michael Skakel is an innocent man? Or was it an ongoing series of legal maneuvers and a rich man's trick? Listener, I'd love to hear your thoughts and theories. But for now, I think that wraps things up. Thank you for listening, and keep the fire burning.
Every day when you log into ChumbaCasino.com, the ultimate online social casino, you get a free daily bonus. Imagine if you got daily bonuses in other parts of your life.
I chose French fries over loaded French fries.
I asked Stuart from accounting about his weekend, even though I don't care.
I updated my operating system without having to call tech support.
Collect your free daily bonus at ChumbaCasino.com now. And live the Chumba life. VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.